Chapter 2, New World Order. After an incredible born-again experience, I joined the Adventist Church in the spring of 1980. Having accepted everything, state of the dead, divinity of Christ, second coming, Sabbath, investigative judgment, I was, from day one, hardcore SDA. What particularly excited me was prophecy, and it was immediately clear how the Adventist prophetic scenario could unfold. First introduced to Revelation 13 and 14 in 1979 during newly installed Pope John Paul II's historic tour of the United States, I saw from the start how trends were moving toward the fulfillment of the third angel's message. I can remember, however, when still a new believer, I was overwhelmed with doubt about an aspect of our prophetic message. What about the Soviet Union? How could our prophetic message ever happen as long as the world faced the guns, tanks, barbed wires, and walls of militant, atheistic Soviet communism? How could the United States, much less the Roman Catholic Church, ever wield the kind of power, international power, depicted in Revelation and interpreted in the Great Controversy as long as the Soviet Union, a highly aggressive superpower implacably hostile to the United States and the Vatican, remained aggressive? A vast imperialistic empire of 290 million people armed with enough strategic and tactical nuclear weapons to incinerate our ashes 100 times over and then roll over them with miles of tanks and armored vehicles wasn't going to disappear overnight. If anything, communism was more firmly entrenched than ever. About the time of the Pope's visit, Soviet troops rolled into neighboring Afghanistan in tanks to prop up a puppet regime. And all President Jimmy Carter did in response was to withhold pole vaulters and other athletes from the Moscow Olympics. A little later, when a Polish electrician named Lech Walesa led a strike at the shipyard in Gdansk, the new Polish leader, General Wojciech Jaruzelski, hurried off to the Kremlin, where his Soviet taskmasters warned that if he didn't crush solidarity with his men, they would with theirs. No doubt the Hungarian 1956 and the Czechoslovakian 1968 revolts help remind the Polish general that his Soviet comrades had a history of invading their non-cooperative European allies. Jaruzelski returned home, Walesa was arrested, solidarity was crushed, and the general's mentor in Moscow appeased. Meanwhile, Saigon had become Ho Chi Minh City, and the Khmer Rouge took over in Cambodia. Haile Selassie's government in Ethiopia was replaced by Marxist, and the socialist Sandinistas gained power in Nicaragua. South Yemen had a Marxist government, and Fidel Castro, thumbing his nose at the Yankees in the north, sent Cuban troops to prop up a Marxist government in Angola. In short, for most of the 80s, the Adventist scenario of the United States enforcing the mark of the beast on the world seemed at best far off, at worst far out. But then, history detoured. Whether it was, as Mr. Fukuyama expressed it, the end of history could be debated. But that it was the end of history as everyone expected history to turn out was beyond debate. Conventional wisdom had it that the East and West would eventually become embroiled in a conflict that would unleash nuclear weapons and we'd annihilate each other. Not an unlikely scenario, all things considered. Yet one thing that wasn't considered, and that was, according to Scripture, an East-West nuclear holocaust was not how it was all going to end. Sooner or later, something had to change, and sooner or later, it did. It began with the death. Leonid Brezhnev, the secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the man credited with taking the Soviet Union from a position of military inferiority to military parity, maybe even superiority, with the United States, died. He was replaced by Yuri Andropov, who, despite rumors that he was a closet liberal, was a dark, hidden figure. He was replaced by Konstantin Chernenko, a semi-catatonic octogenarian who looked in bomb when he took the job, and a few months later, he was. Then a new face appeared, an obscure to the West Minister of Agriculture, young enough not to need a cue card to say anything more complicated than hello or goodbye. The faith, birthmark included, belonged to Mikhail Gorbachev. And just as the Lord used Cyrus, one of the truly enlightened rulers of ancient times, to fulfill his prophetic plans in that era, so he used Gorbachev to fill his plans in ours. Of course, Gorby was no James Madison or Thomas Jefferson. He was a pragmatist who inherited an economic system that was fast turning the Soviet Union into the world's biggest banana republic, except they barely had bananas. Gorbachev obviously needed to make changes. He did, and soon new words like perestroika and glasnost entered our vernacular. Already they seemed so outdated, which shows how fast things have changed. The old world order was unraveling faster than anyone, even Gorbachev, expected, and soon we entered into that gray, nebulous zone called the New World Order. The phrase was popularized by President George Bush after Saddam Hussein turned Kuwait into Iraq's 19th province. On October 30, 1990, the former president declared that the UN can, quote, help bring about a new day, a new world order. In Prague that November, he said that the Gulf crisis offered a historic opportunity to forge, quote, for all nations a new world order, close quote. In a State of the Union address, he mentioned that the long-held promise of a new world order. And speaking in Georgia to families of troops in the Gulf, the president asserted that, quote, there is no place for lawless aggression in the Persian Gulf and in this new world order that we seek to create, close quote. The expression itself has been around long before the president turned it into Virgo Lobo of the 90s. Everyone from David Rockefeller to Adolf Hitler has used the phrase or a reasonable facsimile thereof. On the back of the side of every dollar bill, below the Masonic symbols of a pyramid and all-seeing eye, is the Latin Novus Ordo Seclorum, which can be translated New World Order. Though it has such a firm, authoritative sound, the New World Order is about as objective as a Rorschach test. Whatever cropped up post-Cold War, wrote Fred Barnes in The New Republic, that was the New World Order. For George Bush, the New World Order entailed some fuzzy notion of collective security under the umbrella of the United Nations. Before he glasnosted himself out of a job, Mikhail Gorbachev envisioned the New World Order as a place where a Soviet Union, renewed by democracy and perestroika, would play a positive and prosperous role within the Brotherhood of Nations. Even John Paul has his own notions of a New World Order. See Chapter 4. When Bush first used the term, he probably thought of it as just a cute little expression like his points of light or read my lips. Though his administration stopped using it in 1991, the phrase has taken on a life of its own, especially among the left and right wing fringe who have done more speculating about these four syllables than they have over Henry Kissinger, the beast, or Gorbachev's head splotch, the mark of the beast. Whatever the New World Order was supposed to be, the phrase did strike a chord among Adventists. It should, because ultimately, for prophecy to be fulfilled the way we have predicted, some type of new world order will have to be established. Here's Ellen White. As America, the land of religious liberty, shall unite with the papacy in forcing the conscious and compelling men to honor the false Sabbath, the people of every country on the globe will be led to follow her example. Obviously, things will have to be different for these predictions to be fulfilled. The biblical warning that, quote, he caused all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, Revelation 13:16, cannot have happened according to our understanding just a few years ago. Ellen White's warning, however, that the final events will be rapid ones, should take on a whole new meaning, because recent events have shown that radical changes can happen faster than any of us imagined. It's no coincidence, either, that the collapse of the Soviet Empire fits squarely into our prophetic scenario. We should have known it was coming. In 1980, during the old world order, I faced moments of raw doubt about our prophetic message. The Soviet Union was like a big brown bear crawling across the pages of Revelation 13 and devouring our interpretation of them, particularly chapters 13 and 14. During those moments, however, the Lord pointed me to the book of Daniel, chapters 2 and 7 in particular. Instantly, images of iron and clay toes, winged leopards, and talking horns spread out across my mind like a home video. The message was clear. The Lord did indeed rule over the nations. If God was in such control that he could predict the rise and fall of the pagan Roman Empire centuries before the events, he could deal with the Soviet one as well. So, reaching out in faith, grasping, quote, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, Hebrews 11:1, I uttered a prayer and pressed ahead, having unanswered questions but also a firm trust in God. 10 years later, as unexpected earth-shaking events unfolded before my eyes, most of those questions were answered, and that trust richly rewarded.